Yesterday, I gave you two pure types, a Gesellschaft and a Gemeinschaft. Remember that from yesterday? Two distinct societal systems, community, society. The Gesellschaft, where everybody in the community is a blood relative. I gave you Chesterfield, New Jersey, when I was there as a young pastor many years ago, 50 years ago. It was almost a Gesellschaft. But note, I said the first one was George Longstreet, the second one was a George Longstreet, the third one was a Longstreet, the fourth one was a Borden. He married into this group. It's no longer pure. No, we're not all blood relatives anymore. We got this one. I was in a town in Vermont some years ago to speak, and they have these little village newspapers, you know, which come out once a week, and they have all the gossip, who visited who went to where on vacation. I mean, they're wonderful little papers. If you want to do sociological studies, those papers are incredible. And you get everything that goes on. The Jones family reports that their daughter Mary in New York got straight A's in her courses at a new school of social. I mean, that's what's going to be in the paper. Everything, all the news is there. I picked up the newspaper one morning. You know, I woke up, you open the door, and there's the newspaper. So I picked it up. Front page story. Get this. A man had died, and his obituary, not on the third page. That's not, I mean, in a small town, when somebody dies, it's front page. Front page obituary said. And this is what it said about the man. I would never forget the words. Although he moved here 47 years ago, he was like one of us. 47 years! And they still say, he's not really one of us. It's no longer a pure Gesellschaft, is it? That there is this interloper, this person who has come in and lived in the community. And yes, we like, and he says, he was like one of us. No, like one of us, but he was not one of us. He is not part of this. It's not a pure Gemeinschaft. There is no such, you won't find a pure Gemeinschaft. There is no such thing. There's always some, maybe in the interior of the jungles of Philippines, you might come across a tribe that nobody has ever made contact with ever before, and that might be a pure Gemeinschaft, but it's hard to find. It's doubtful whether it ever exists. It's a pure type. It's used for the purpose of comparison. Nor is there such a thing as a pure Gesellschaft. I mean, you may change activities every time. You may change groups every time you change activities, as I was saying yesterday. But the reality is what? That when you go to school, what do you know? There is this one kid in my class who goes to my church. There is this one guy on the bowling team. There's two guys on my bowling team that go to my school. Do you begin to see that there's overlapping? It's not a pure type. So you say, what's the point? Well, you know now what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a continuum. Gemeinschaft, Gesellschaft. And when we analyze a community, we can figure where along that continuum we are going to place this community. What is this community like? To what degree is it a Gesellschaft? To what degree is it a Gemeinschaft? You see how you use these concepts, these hypothetical constructs, for the purpose of evaluation. Do you understand this? Any questions on this? So there, you know, there is no such thing as a pure type Thatcher gang structure. It doesn't exist. But in his analysis of gangs, he came up with certain generalizations. Note, all pure type, all ideal types emerge out of empirical research. I mean, he was studying all the gangs, and he said, here's the thing that I find evident in gang groups. Now, it doesn't apply to every group and every situation, but generally this is, so they're generalizations that emerge out of empirical study. And then, in fact, they are made ideal. Namely, you, in coming up with the ideal type, you ignore certain things and you over-accentuate other things to come out with this pure type model. Do you follow it? Ideal types are very important for sociology because we are always comparing things. When I talk about natural zones, natural areas of Robert Park, it's an ideal type. You know, you're going to be able to find all kinds of deviations and exceptions to the natural zone phenomena. But generally, you use this and you say, I'm going to understand this area in these terms. Now, this is so crucial, as I said, for ministry, because ministry will not be able to cross natural zones. You will not be able to bring people in from outside. Somebody who working in Camden and somebody working in Philadelphia, wonderful young people like yourselves who came in and worked in great ministry in these places, decided to run 3 nights of revival meetings. Wouldn't it be great if we brought all the kids from Camden to Philadelphia and put them all in one church and had this wonderful woman who can really preach, deliver the gospel to them? Whew. The group came in from Camden, and there were about 150 of them, and there were about 150 of the kids from the Philadelphia program that were in this sanctuary. So the place is packed with 300 kids. And the service starts, and somebody said something. Nobody knows what it was. Hell broke loose. The fight started, and it wasn't just a fight over here and a fight like over here. Every kid in the place, male and female, were physically fighting, banging on each other, throwing each other, punching each other. Girls beating on girls, and they had that much respect. Girls beat on girls, boys beat on boys. But the place was chaos. I mean, it was just a riot. They called the cops. Bruce Main said, I only wish I had my movie camera, because it was like 50 police cars come descending on this place almost all at once with sirens blaring and lights flashing. And these cops come charging in, and they were all arrested, all 300 of them. I know this because I was in Spokane, Washington, speaking at Whitworth College. And I wanted to call the next morning to ask about a particular problem that they were having in Camden. And this young woman answered the phone, very casual, said, is so-and-so there? No. Okay. Is so-and-so there? I'm in this residence hall. No. I kept on naming people. I said, where is everybody? Without hesitation, the woman said, they're all in jail. Why are they in jail? And then she began to tell me this horrendous story. But you cannot cross. I mean, it wasn't a race issue. These were Hispanic and African-American kids in Philadelphia, Hispanic and African-American kids in Camden. It wasn't a race thing. It had nothing to do with race. It had everything to do with, you don't belong in our neck of the woods. You don't belong here. This is not an area that belongs to you. You're in a place where we are in control, and you don't mess around in our territory. You come in if we invite you. Incidentally, this thing gets so organized, natural zones. It gets so organized that they begin to define safe passage routes. Safe passage routes. For instance, the kids in one natural area have to go to school in another natural area. I'm a black kid, but the Board of Education has assigned me to a school that sits right in the middle of the Italian neighborhood. Am I going to get beat up on my way to school? Answer is no, as long as you go on the prescribed street. And these, again, emerge sui generis. There are prescribed streets. And if you go on that street and you're a black person in the Italian neighborhood, nobody's going to touch you. However, if you wander off that street, you're in real trouble. You have to, as you go into a community to minister in the name of Jesus, you got to know all these things. This is what it means to be streetwise. Do you know the natural barriers? Do you know the safe routes to take to and from certain places where you're allowed to go? I mean, obviously, people have to cross each other's territory. Do you cross each other's territory in the socially prescribed way? Because it's all spelled out. All of this highly organized stuff emerges the word sui generis. Nobody plans it. One of the things that you'll love in Philadelphia, which is a hangover from the early part of the 20th century, it's a hangover. It's called the Mummers Parade. How many of you know about the Mummers Parade, you see? Now, people from David, like you, Iowa, you don't know about the Mummers Parade. The interesting thing is the size of the Mummers Parade dwarfs the Rose Bowl Parade, dwarfs the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. It's the biggest parade you'll ever see. It starts at about 7 in the morning and ends somewhere around 8:30 at night with groups moving down Broad Street. It's on New Year's Day. It's a New Year's Day. And what happened is in the early part of the 20th century, Broad Street was one of those safe passage streets. It was neutral territory. What happened is that on New Year's Eve, what do a bunch of Italians do? Do they simply play bingo? Do they simply sing hymns and sing Kumbaya in Italian? What do? They have party with a little anisette, a little wine. Hey, come on, it's New Year's. Hey, salute. By about 3 o'clock in the morning, what are they? Drunk. Guess what? Just down the way is the Irish neighborhood. And we always said in the Italian neighborhood, God invented whiskey to keep the Irish from conquering the world. They're over there and they're drinking their Irish stuff. You know, they're putting down their Irish whiskey. And they're, by 3 in the morning, guess what they are? Drunk. The Germans are doing the same thing. They're not drinking wine. They're not drinking whiskey. They're drinking beer. See, note, each natural area has its own culture. What you drink in one neighborhood is different than what you drink in another neighborhood. Got the picture? But the net result is that everybody's drunk by 3 o'clock in the morning. And when you're drunk, you begin doing things. You spill out on the street, you know. You got certain hostilities against certain groups. Let's go over there and beat those harps. And there emerged on Broad Street in Philadelphia massive ethnic fights. The city fathers and mothers back in those days, and I don't know how it came to be, figured out that this was going to happen. The question is, can we create nonviolent competition? This is crucial in sociology. Nonviolent competition. Let me point out something that will give you an idea of what I'm talking about. We all know that in Belfast, Ireland, there's incredible conflict between the Catholics and the Protestants, right? They've been killing each other for hundreds of years. Agreed? The interesting thing is that just 45 miles away in Glasgow, Scotland, you have the same ethnic composition. The same number, proportion of the population is Catholic. The same proportion is Protestant. They come from the same ethnic communities. And what's more is they are so connected with each other that the relatives in one place have relatives in the other place. People in Belfast are related to families in Glasgow and vice versa, both in the Catholic side and the Protestant side. But there are no violent confrontations between Protestants and Catholics in Glasgow. Why not? It's the same people, it's the same families, it's the same ethnic groups, it's the same everything. Why don't they kill each other in Glasgow? Answer. Most cities have a professional ball team. Philadelphia has the Phillies and the Eagles, right, and the Sixers. We have professional teams. So it is in the United Kingdom. Every city has a soccer team. You know, the Manchester United. You know, you got Newcastle United. You got all of these teams. And these people are zealously connected to their teams. If you know anything about England, I mean, it's awesome. They solved the problem. Nobody knows whether anybody ever did this deliberately. But there's not one professional soccer team in Glasgow. There's two. And for years and years and years, it went like this, that the Protestants had the Rangers and the Catholics had the Celtics. They were the two teams. And whenever these two teams played, everybody showed up. And all the hostilities and anger were played out on the soccer field. All the animosities were played out on the soccer field. Now, it's broken down a little bit now because what we find is that the fans sometimes are not satisfied with the outcome of the game. And you know what's been happening over there with these, they call them hooligans, who after the game's over decide to beat up on each other. It's only become a recent problem. But for years, there were no wars between the Catholic and Protestants in Glasgow because the wars took place on the soccer field. I say nonviolent forms of resolving your tensions. I'm not sure that the soccer games were that nonviolent, but nevertheless, that was the way in which it was done. So you got to find a nonviolent way for people to express their hostilities. That's good sociology. And the result was the Mummers Parade. And the Mummers Parade was ultimately emerged. If you want to compete, what you do is you put together a group of mummers. Now, mummers are people who are the strangest folks you have ever met in your life. You've got to go. It is the most, you have never seen anything like it. You think, you say, how come the whole world doesn't know about this? From January 2nd, for a whole year, the Italian-American Club gets together and they make these costumes. When I say costumes, I'm not talking about costumes. I am talking about the weirdest concoctions you've ever seen. Lots and lots of feathers. Not roses, feathers. Huge amounts of feathers. You say, what do you mean huge? If the wind is blowing at more than 10 miles an hour, they have to call off the parade. I'm kidding, I'm telling you. Because the wind will just blow everybody over. Now, you've seen the outfits, right? They're gigantic. They go up like about 6 feet up over the individual, 3 feet in all directions, and they walk down the road like this. Do you see? Holding up these things. And they're magnificent. They are incredibly colorful. And they are built around themes. And there's a Mummers March. As a matter of fact, there's one song that has become classic in the Mummers Parade. It's Oh, Those Golden Slippers. Having participated in the Mummers Parade, I know the Mummers move. Here it is. And if you go to the Mummers Museum, there is a museum, I'll tell you about it in just a minute. The last thing you do is go into this one room and this old Italian lady teaches everybody that comes to the museum how to do the Mummers strut. Have you been to that museum?
And watched you do it.
And watch it, right. You go, and you hold these things up, these enormous things that you got, and you start dancing, and the music is, Oh, Those Golden Slippers, and you go, Oh, them golden slippers, oh, them golden slippers. You got to turn in a certain way. Golden slippers gone away to walk those golden streets. Now you get thousands and thousands of people going, oh, them golden slippers. It's mind-boggling. You've got to see it. You've got to see it. And you go down there, and there's a museum on Washington Avenue and 3rd Street. These are things you should see. You should go down to Friday afternoon, you ought to go to the Mummers Museum. Friday night, you ought to go to 9th and Washington Avenue. And you begin to find out what a city's all about. And a city, it becomes incredibly interesting. And when I say suburbs are boring, I'm not kidding you. Do they have Mummers parades in King of Prussia? Do they have any of this? Do they have a market out on the street? No, they've got shopping malls. And if you've been to one shopping mall, I don't want to knock it, you have been to the mall. And they have these bands. And the problem is that most ethnic groups did not play metal instruments, trumpets, trombones. They didn't play these instruments. If it was a group of Mexicans, you know you would have that, wouldn't you? You'd have them playing mariachi bands, marching. These are Italians. What do Italians play? Mandolins. What do our Irish people play? Harps, violins. Well, this is the middle of the winter. You're not going to have people playing violins and banjos and out on the street, are you? Because yes, you are. And so these aren't just bands. They're famous. They're called string bands. Once again, the whole ethnic lifestyle becomes incorporated in the march. And of course, you march down the street and you get to City Hall and there's the grandstand there and you perform in front of the grandstand and you're judged. And the next day in the Philadelphia Inquirer, they will say, which the Italian-American club came in first, or the German-American club came in second, or the Ukrainian. There's a Ukrainian community. The Ukrainian-American. Each, and you'll just see all these ethnic groups labeled there as they compete with one another. And these bands have become incredibly, it's great music. These are great displays. The costumes are magnificent. Remember, they're working on this almost every night for a year to get ready for the parade. And so all the hostility between these ethnic groups gets worked out in what? A non-violent way. Now, William White Jr.'s book, Street Corner Society, there's a great situation that emerges in this Italian neighborhood in Boston. There are two gangs. But I said earlier, one of the ways of handling a gang is to direct them in a positive direction. So there were these two gangs in the Italian neighborhood. One gang got oriented towards academic achievement. As a matter of fact, within a few years, the entire political system of the area was saturated with these people. They were district attorneys. They were in the city council. They were lawyers. They had become upwardly mobile. It was incredibly successful. This gang was oriented. I don't know who got them in that direction, but they got oriented to academic achievement. So the way you gained status in the gang was to get great good grades. Needless to say, the other gang was not this way. And the conflict began to get greater and greater and greater. And sooner or later, there was going to be blood on the streets. I don't know who negotiated it. It was probably the runners negotiated it. The two groups had one thing in common. They both loved to bowl. And each of the groups was in a bowling league, different bowling league to be sure. Now they could beat each other up and kill each other, or they could have a bowling match. And that's what happened. And the book describes how these two gangs come together the night of the bowling match. Can you imagine these guys walking in, gonna eat you up, mother? This is not just a bowling match. There is much more involved in this. And they bowl against each other. Once again, resolving the conflict in a nonviolent way. What was interesting, if you read Street Corner Society, is that there are dimensions to the bowling game that nobody figured was going to happen. Namely, each of these gangs has within it, remember, a gang is a subculture. Every gang has its own values, its own subculture in itself. And every culture has a stratification system. There are some upper class people, middle class people, lower class people. And so it is with a gang. There are those who are at the top, there are those who are in the middle, there are those on the bottom. What happened when they checked out the bowling scores was that those who had the highest status in the group had the highest scores, and those who had the lowest status had the lowest scores. Now, the question is, were they at the bottom of the ladder because they were poor bowlers? Or were they poor bowlers because they were at the bottom of the ladder? Quote, W.I. Thomas, I cast it off so simply the other day. If things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences. If I define myself as inferior to this guy over here when the bowling takes place, unconsciously, it's going to happen. He's going to do better than I am going to do. Namely, I am predisposed to being inferior because it's in my head. This is going to play out heavily as we talk about race relations in the city. It's what people think about themselves and what they think about the others that define on how they're going to behave. Namely, African-American kids do very poorly in the public schools in Philadelphia. Well, you say because they're stupid. Oh, no. Not at all. They're not stupid. I told you about the kids we put in that little school in the basement of a church, that homeschool academy, that by the time they finished, they all went on to college. They're not stupid. Then why do they behave so poorly? Because they think they're stupid. And why do they think they're stupid? Because the dominant society describes them as stupid. Do you see what's going on here? If things are real in the imagination, and what we find, of course, is inner city kids do poorly in school. Why? Because they know that society at large expects them to do poorly. Note that we talked about the significant other yesterday. You know, your self-image, Charles Cooley, is determined by what you think other people think of you. Charles Cooley says, in addition to the significant other, there is also, here's the word, generalized other. People say, you can't go to that meeting dressed like that. They'll all laugh at you. They? Who are they? Do you know these people by name? No. Well, how do you know they are going to laugh at you? Because I have this concept of what generally is true of this group of people. And so African-American boys and girls have to grow up in a context of the generalized other. Their models become what? Comedians on television and athletes. Comedians and athletes, these are their models. And even there, we see it acted out. If things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences. You won't understand the mess we're in America unless you understand the head trip that we put on black kids. They don't do well in school because they are not expected to do well in school. White people do better because they are expected to do better. Now we got a problem on our hands. A kid in Radnor Township that I know came home. He was all excited about his math score. He did, and he said, you know what? You know what, Uncle Tony? I beat out all the Asians. I mean, that's the new group now that's looked upon as intellectually superior. I asked my son-in-law, who is the executive vice president and executive secretary of Harvard University, about affirmative action. I said, do you have affirmative action? He says, of course we have affirmative action. If we didn't have affirmative action, 3/4 of the school would be Asian. Not because they're smarter. Because the differentiation between races intellectually is negligible. I mean, every test that's ever been done shows the same thing. There's no significant difference. Then why does one group do so much better than another group? Because they are expected to do better. Do you begin to see how this all works out? Natural areas, they create their own subcultures. They give people an idea of what they are able to do and what they are not able to do. So what are going to be the test scores in one natural area if you go to school, when you take the SATs? Are they going to be different than the kids in another area? And people are going to be saying, you see, black people really are inferior. Did you see their SAT scores? Did you see what their verbal scores are, what their math scores are? Did you see what their scores are? And look over here in this Jewish neighborhood. Are Jews expected to do very well in school? You bet they are. Incidentally, the story of my life is an interesting one. I have two older sisters. Family lived in South Philadelphia. This is pure ethnic mindset, cultural values. And 10 years after my last sister was born, I came. I was the surprise baby. I was the unexpected pregnancy. And I'm born and I'm a boy. Culture. How do Italian ethnics feel about boys as opposed to girls? You got it. You got it. I got a son, man, I got a son. Whoa. My father said, if we raise our family from this point on in the Italian neighborhood, I know what's going to happen to my son. I know what he's going to become. He's going to be out on the street. He's going to be partying all the time. He's not going to take school seriously. He's not going anywhere. He'll be an automobile mechanic. These are the actual words of my father. At that point, he took our Italian family and moved us into a section of West Philadelphia that was totally Jewish. Not 10% Jewish, totally Jewish. He wanted his son raised with Jews because he wanted his son to take school seriously. And you know what? It worked. I have all kinds of cousins who are every bit as smart as I am. They never went beyond high school. I went beyond high school because I grew up with what? The Jews. And after a while, you begin to think of yourself as a Jew. My Jewish friends always had fun with me. I remember Albert Finkelstein, who used to walk to school with me. And he used to say, you know the difference between my family and your family, Tony? Here's cultural differentiations. When we leave my house, my mother always says, Albert, do you have your books? When we leave your house, your mother always says, Tony, do you have your lunch? These are ethnic differentiations. But I was raised in this environment where you took school seriously. I played on the basketball team. And we had Jewish guys on the basketball team. It was a custom at West Philadelphia High for there to be one day when the whole team cut school. It was expected. The school didn't even come down on it. It was expected. And furthermore, you wouldn't get mad at your kids for cutting school for this reason. We always did the same thing. You know what we did? The day we cut school, this is our big deviant behavior day. We're going to cut school. The whole gang of us are going to cut school. Yes, we'd always cut school the day that they had the Shakespeare Festival in Philadelphia. Can you imagine a bunch of basketball players going to see a Shakespeare play? This is not what a group of Italian kids would do. They would go to the burlesque show, I guarantee you. We were there. I mean, it conditioned me. It completely structured my personality. We had a high school reunion, and our high school was pretty well divided between African Americans and Jewish people. So our school was half and half. They elected me president of the student body for obvious reasons. I was the compromise candidate. Seriously, the blacks wanted a black guy. The Jews wanted a Jewish guy. And they recognized that this was not a good thing, so they elected the one Italian. And I doubt if there were 4,000 students. Yes, I do remember. Oh, no, they were Spanish. That's right, they were Hispanic. They were Annette Ortegon. I remember her. Whoa, do I remember Annette Ortegon? Yeah, I remember. There was just a handful of us there. I mean, it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. This is the way it was. And when I was there, I said two things. Number one, I owe everything to growing up in West Philadelphia. The Jewish people here socialized me into academia. And my African-American brothers and sisters socialized me into spirituality. I went to a church that ultimately closed down, and the nearest Baptist church was an African-American church, 58th and Ray Street, Mount Carmel Baptist Church. So I went, and I've been there since I was 18 years old. I started going there even earlier because on the cross-country team where I was for one semester, there was a guy named Henderson who liked me, and I liked him, and he took me to his church. And I started going to youth group there because he was there and he was the star of the team and he was a neat guy and I just hung around with him. And I got involved in this African-American church and we had a Bible club at West Philadelphia High. It was overwhelmingly the black kids. The Jewish kids weren't coming to our Bible club. It was overwhelming. And suddenly I began to feel the presence of Christ as a black person would. Evidence of this. Once a year at Howard University, the big and prestigious, the most prestigious black university in America, Howard University in Washington, D.C., has a black ministerial, a black preacher series, in which they invite in the black preachers, the best black preachers in America. Every year, they invite me. And the point they want to make is preaching black has nothing to do with your skin. It has to do with your style. I wrote a book called The Enslaved Church, which we'll make reference to as we talk about race relations in the city. The Enslaved Church. I did it in cooperation with a brilliant African-American kid from Duke University who went on to be Bishop Tutu's assistant, who finished off with a doctorate at Princeton. And we wrote this book together, viewing race relations in the church from the time this country was founded up to the present. Looking at it, he's a historian. He looked at it historically. I looked at it sociologically. He described what happened. Sociologists explained what happened. And that was what we did. But when we do presentations, and we do them about once a month, people invite us in for a book review of this book. I can always count on Michael Battle, the sophisticated guy whose parents were on the faculty at Duke, who raised, grew up in the Duke cultural system, who went to Princeton. How white can you get? As he makes his presentation, he always says, what we're pointing out here is you have an interesting situation. You have a white man who preaches black, and you've got a black man who preaches white. These are the subtleties that you begin to observe. That's why people often say, why do you want to become a sociologist? The answer is quite simple. Because I want to understand why the world is the way it is. If we're going to change the world, we have to understand why it is the way it is. And natural zones, natural areas, explain how gangs come into being, explain how subcultures come into being, how a city can never be looked at as a whole. It always must be broken down into natural areas. Do you understand this? If you're doing a sociological analysis, you have to go into a neighborhood and figure where the natural barriers are, what the natural zone is, analyze the subculture of that zone, and recognize that what you discover about that zone does not apply to what is two blocks away. Do we understand each other? And if you have a church, remember, people you'll have no way of reaching out to the people in that church. Now, I'll tell you what you can do. You can have the church in a neighborhood where the folks who attend the church are in no way ethnically related to the neighborhood. That's okay. You can drive in on Sunday and go to church and go home, and nobody will bother you. If you're doing evangelism, you have to, in fact, treat a gang, as I said yesterday, as a whole. You're not going to convert individuals, because if an individual wants to leave the gang, it becomes a problem. The best thing to do is to convert the whole gang. Now, there are exceptions to this. We found in our inner city work in West Philadelphia that we could separate individuals from the gang. But here's what we had to do. This is interesting. We slowly learned that the only way to separate the individual from the gang, let's say the Passiacome gang or the Washington Square gang, whatever gang, is you had to baptize the person. But you don't baptize the person in the church. You bring a bathtub into the neighborhood. And while everybody stands around, you baptize them. Not so that the church people can see, but so the entire community can see. The gang will let you go at that point, because somehow you belong to God and you don't mess with God. But you need some power. And it's the only time, you know, when you look at what baptism was meant to do in the early church, that's exactly what it was meant to do. It was an initiation right into church membership. Baptism was meant to be a public declaration that you have become part of this new community of faith. As a matter of fact, in the ancient church, they even gave you a white robe when you came out. So you read in the book of Revelation, and it made you very vulnerable, because now everybody knew who the Christians were in town because they were dressed in white robes, and it was easy to kill them. And no wonder it says in the book of Revelation, and I asked the Lord, who are these who are dressed in white garments? Says Jesus, these are they who have been washed in the blood of the Lamb. Whoa. It was a public display. You didn't become a Christian secretly. I became a Christian secretly. I went to my high school reunion after 25 years, and this Jewish kid came up to me, and he said, hey, Campolo, I got to tell you something. I said, what is it? Got me over to the side. He said, we always hung out together in school. I got to tell you, So, and we always shared everything. We always shared everything, and we did. We shared sweaters. He had one sweater, I had one sweater, and you didn't want to wear the same sweater every day. No, this is true. You got to get a little bit of city life in here. He said, we shared everything. He said, I got to share with you something. Last year, I became a Christian. I gave my life to Jesus, and Jesus is in my life. I can't tell you the change. And his face was radiant. He went on and on and on. And as he said this, I said, hey, Jerry, this is incredible. He said, did you become a Christian too? I said, yes, I'm a Christian too. Oh, great. He hugged me. This is wonderful, wonderful. When did you become a Christian? I said, I think I was 15 years old. And he looked at me and he said, and you never told me? You never shared that with me? And he wasn't basically condemning me. What he was shocked. Because having come to Christ from the outside rather than being raised in the church, it was such an awesome thing that he couldn't help but tell everybody. He becomes obnoxious. Do you ever meet a new convert? They grab people. Do you know what happened to me? They don't stop. They foam at the mouth. They're wild. And he was wild. And he wanted to know why I wasn't wild at the age of 15. Why I could become a Christian and not let everybody know. Baptizing a person publicly immediately differentiates that person from the rest of the crowd. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody do this. It just happened to work very well in this particular situation. How do we get this kid out of the gang? Gangs are powerful. I do a lot of work in Ireland and Northern Ireland particularly. I'll be in Belfast preaching in about a month and a half. Here's the interesting thing. Then in Belfast, if you belong to the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, you can't leave. It's a gang. It's a violent gang. You can't leave. If you leave, they'll kill you. Because they're afraid that you'll expose the other members of the gang and divulge the secrets of the gang, that the IRA will not be safe if you leave. So I was doing a meeting over there, and a kid came under conviction, and it was a member of the IRA, came down the island and accepted his Christ as his Savior. And he knew this was back in the days of what they call the Troubles. They call that whole period of violence, the Troubles. Within a week after having become a Christian, we had to not only get him out of Belfast, we had to get him out of the United Kingdom. We arranged for him to fly to America and go and live in Americus, Georgia, and join Habitat for Humanity as a full-time worker. It was the only escape. Namely, you can't stay here anymore. You've become a Christian. You can't participate in the bombing. They don't trust you anymore. Gangs are serious business. That's an extreme case. But I'll tell you, it's pretty tough to understand gangs, how they emerge, how they're related to natural areas. They don't call them natural areas. Gangs call the area what? Turf. It's our turf. You're on our turf, baby. Do you see? They don't use sociological terminology. It's our turf. And they understand which turf belongs to them and which turf belongs to other groups. In ministering, remember this. In all probability, you will only be able to minister, if you're an inner city person, within a given natural area. Because when you step out of the natural area, you move into another culture and you don't know how to relate to it.